This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is going to be presenting a friend of mine who I have known for quite a number of years, and many of you may have known him as well. Your lives may have intersected in different ways. For those around the world, you may not necessarily have heard of him, but again, that's one of the advantages of listening to the Magic Word Podcast, because you get to meet new friends. This particular gentleman has so much to offer because he has been performing magic for over 70 years. Yeah, that's seven decades. Count them. He has recently done a big show in order to celebrate his 70th anniversary, and I think now he's been doing magic for even a couple of years past that. I think it's like 72 or 74 years he's been performing since he was a youth, when he was known as Misto. He had a Mr. Misto set. Anyhow, he'll tell you a little bit about that then as well. Lives in Austin, Texas, been a past president of the Texas Association of Magicians. So many things that he has done in his life while he was performing in the military, and different organizations he's performed for that are just going to blow you away. Leading up to our conversation here, I met with Kent in his Magic Museum. It's the Fantastic Magic Center there in Austin. It's quite unusual. It's a duplex house in which he purchased one half of this house. So he has half of the duplex, which no one lives there. He has converted every room into a magic room, including the kitchen, the bathroom, the closets. He even converted the garage into a performance theater, complete with chairs and a stage and curtains, lights, and everything. It's amazing. It's just fantastic. And it is only available to see and to view by appointment. So if you contact him, I'm sure he'll be glad and very happy and pleased and proud to show you through this, because it's not just a magic museum, but it really is the Kent Cummins Museum. And he will explain some of that as we talk about that here today, too. But if you want to see some of the photos that I had taken while I was walking through the museum, be sure to go to the MagicWordPodcast.com website for this week's episode number 680, and you will see some pictures of him as he's pointing out some of the posters and memorabilia there in the Fantastic Magic Center. It's always good to sit down with someone who knows more than you do. And certainly everyone knows a lot more than I do. So that's why I'm always interested in learning more from those who have not just gone on before us, but also excelled in so many different ways. And he is not only a magician, but also on the National Speakers Association, the Bureau. And he is also a keynote speaker, has written several books on magic motivation. I should say using magic as a way of motivating. Anyhow, he and his partner, business partner Tom Britton, have written a book. And anyhow, this is all fascinating stuff. And I could go on, but I'm going to let this unfold as he explains a lot more about this. I'm sure you will have a new friend after you have heard this episode, as I have had for a long, long time. Please welcome my good friend, the fantastic Kent Cummins, here on The Magic Word. Today we are in Austin, Texas, and we are at the Fantastic Magic Austin, sorry, the Fantastic Magic Center, which is a museum. He's going to correct me, I'm sure, just a few moments, because he had the Fantastic Magic Camp, and he is known as the Fantastic Kent Cummins. And Kent is just I don't know what to say, other than being kind of a Renaissance type of a guy, in which everything that he's done. I will say this, he has celebrated recently over 70, that's 70 years in magic and performing, not just having an interest in magic, and we'll talk about that then too and how that came about. But just a very, very interesting guy with a multi-layer background and in marketing, and perhaps you may have read some of his books or seen some of his read articles in Linking Ring Magazine and elsewhere, perhaps, or if you're in Austin, may have seen him. He's been the auctioneer at the Fantastic Magic, always has fantastic in there, Fantastic Magic Auction.
Actually,
The correct name is the world famous Austin Magic Auction.
Okay, there's no fantastic.
There's no fantastic in that. It is fantastic, yes. But it's not in the name.
It is world famous, and tens of thousands of dollars have passed hands per auction. It's just certainly amazing. And in addition to that, having a sandwich shop in right downtown within the shadow of the state capitol here in Austin, Texas. Enough for me. Let's hear from our friend. Please welcome Mr. Kent Cummins. Hey, Kent, how are you?
Hello, Scott. I am delighted to be showing off the Fantastic Magic Center to one of my longtime very good friends.
Well, thank you. I love talking with friends, and that's what this whole podcast is really about, because this way we get to kind of share some ideas and let people recognize the friendships that we all have had. We were so lucky to be in this community of magicians who are all so great. And you showed me a room over there a while ago in the center of people who have influenced your life.
Magicians who have inspired me, absolutely.
Such as?
Well, Houdini, of course.
Yeah.
And then Harry Blackstone Sr., the first magician I ever saw perform. And I did have the opportunity to run down the aisle and put my hand on the birdcage before it disappeared.
How awesome is that?
So
1950?
50, 51, somewhere around in there.
Yeah.
In San Antonio at the Majestic Theater, a place where I saw David Copperfield quite a few years later. Mm-hmm. But I never really met Blackstone to talk to him. I'm sorry about that, but I did get to know his son, Harry Blackstone Jr., and we actually did some projects together. But so both of those Blackstones are well represented in the Room of Magicians who inspire me, and the great Scott and Judy.
Fred Scott Donaldson.
Fred Scott Donaldson. You were also a great Scott, and mm-hmm. there have been a few others, but mm-hmm. they were the dominant magicians in Austin when I moved back here in 1976, and they had so much to do with my career, and they were such good friends. Fred and I would talk for hours on typically not magic. We were genuine, just friends.
Did you live, or were you born in Austin? I mean, I know that you overseas, and you were in the military and performed in NCO clubs and all that, and we'll get to that in a minute, but did you start in Austin and came back? Or?
No, I was born in Del Rio. My folks are both from San Antonio. Okay. Del Rio's a little town down by the border. And I think we came to Austin once to see the state capitol, but I didn't have any real memories of Austin. But the Army offered me an opportunity to go to graduate school. And so I got my MBA here at the University of Texas. And Margo and I just fell in love with Austin. And once I
Margo, left, your wife now, of course.
Margo, my wife. Mm-hmm. And when I left active duty, we both agreed, no, we need to go back to Austin.
And when you came here, that's when you opened up the sandwich shop.
Yeah. People sometimes question how I could have done all these things, but they all overlap.
Yeah.
I'm a retired Army colonel. I ran a chain of sandwich shops that we started for 15 years. I've been a magician for 72 years. But all of these things overlap.
Mm-hmm. Because you had magic at the sandwich shop, too, didn't you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I've had magic everywhere. After that first 6 years.
Yeah. I went to the sandwich shop. I came and visited a few times.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember what the name of it was.
The Sam Witch Shop.
Oh, Witch.
W-I-T-C-H.
That's right,
yep.
Sam. That's
a witch
right.
named Sam.
Yeah.
And so I've done all these things together. So, for example, I came to Austin while I was an Army captain mm-hmm. because the Army sent me here to get my MBA at UT.
Yeah.
And my best friend, John Shakesnyder, was here getting his master's degree at UT, and so we started the sandwich shop chain while we were both in graduate school.
Wow. And students holding down full-time retail
And also shop. My son was born that year. So I had a lot of things going on all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Boy, I should say so. And you've always had, it seems to me, more of an interest in stage as opposed to close-up. I haven't really seen you do finger-flicking a lot of card stuff.
I've done it, of course, but no, I love the stage magic. Mm-hmm. As I said, Blackstone Sr. was the first magician I ever saw.
Don't you think that's fading? I mean, I see fewer and fewer people who are capable even of doing stage and having fewer illusions.
It's harder. It's more expensive to get the props. Logistically, it requires more. Mm-hmm. And people don't have the same role models. I mean, my role models were stage magicians.
Mm-hmm.
And people's role models now are Shimlin and you know, so many really good close-up magicians.
Right. Well, that's a good point. And I think also the level of entry, that is the money you have to spend, is just for a deck of cards as opposed to a big zigzag or something.
That's right.
Yeah. Plus, I think there'd be fewer places to perform. We don't have the theaters and nightclubs and whatever there were of yesteryear, as opposed to people walking around restaurants or going table to table and bar.
I've often said that I make my living as a magician, that my hobby is magic illusions, stage illusions.
And you make some, too.
Because I have performed a lot of stage illusions, and I use them whenever I can. But that's not the primary way I've earned my living. The primary way I've earned my living is through magic with a message, using magic as a way to educate and inspire, not just to entertain.
When I was on the board of directors of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, we had you come in. I don't remember that Tom Britton was with you at the time.
No, I was with Gus Davis, Gusto the Great.
And Gus was the one who worked with C.J. Johnson now, right?
He did work with C.J. Johnson. Now he works independently with my other friend, James Caldwell.
Oh, I didn't know that. I know I broke away from CJ because they were doing the game show thing.
Right.
Okay. Touring with schools as well for doing that. So when you had come through and it was like a 2 or 3 day workshop and team building kind of a thing. So that was your bread and butter.
A team building weekend. And I did those for the other IBM as well.
Mm-hmm.
I've done team building weekends for both IBMs and for Dell and, you know, Motorola.
Well, Dell's here in Austin. I mean, this is their hometown.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, yes, that's really the way I was making my living. And so It was fun to be able to share that with the magic community and to do some of those things that we did for Dell, you know, for some of the most influential magicians that were on the board of International Brotherhood of Magicians.
And you were always incorporating some magic in those team building exercises too.
Absolutely. I incorporate magic into just about everything.
I mentioned Tom Britton, and Tom was your business partner as far
co-author.
As one of the co-author of the book. It's Marketing Magic?
The Magic of Change.
Magic of Change. I've got two copies of those. I think you had two different editions or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
The hardbound edition was by an independent publisher. It was in all the bookstores, and it was ready in 1999. And Tom and I said, we don't want copyright 1999 in the book. In the 2000s,
mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm.
we released it in January of 2000.
Just waited a few more months. That's a great idea.
Yeah, and
good marketing.
And we love the book. We read it ourselves from time to time because nobody likes change, and we don't either.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, we've written the book on it, and so occasionally we read it ourselves to inspire ourselves. And he and I were having coffee one day, and he said, "Kent, have you read it lately?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Did you notice that we say things like you should listen to cassette tapes in the car?" I said, "Yeah." And we talk about Blockbuster Video as a good example of a business. And
it'll be here forever.
Yeah. So we agreed that we needed to update the book. We liked the book.
Yeah.
And the majority of it, 85 to 90% of it, was still spot on as far as
it's
we
like
were
Tarbell
concerned.
Is talking about Clark Gable, for an example.
Exactly.
The tricks are good, but it's kind of outdated.
Right. Exactly. And so we changed some of the stories
mm-hmm.
so that they were more up to date.
Sure.
And Tom's wife, Dina, was the one who did the layout for our book
mm-hmm.
For the publisher. And so we still had that. And what we did was any page that we had to change, we made sure that the change would fit on the same page. So we didn't have to change the table of contents.
Oh, that is good thinking.
We agreed to go ahead and print it softbound using Amazon, you know, CreateSpace and whatever, because we didn't need to be in the bookstores anymore. That wasn't our goal. Our goal now was to have a more updated version to give to corporate clients and to the grandchildren.
Have you got something that you can do print on demand so you can change some pages if you need to?
Oh, of course.
And still go back and if you need to change like
absolutely.
Blockbuster to whatever kind of thing.
I've got several books that are in that. Mm-hmm. That place, yep.
Now, another thing, by the way, as an aside, Tom's wife, Dina, that you mentioned, is a professional ventriloquist.
Absolutely. I've known Tom since 1961.
Mm-hmm.
We were both in the Texas Association of Magicians.
And you're past president, of course.
Yes, but that was 1983. But Tom and I were kids mm-hmm. in 1961, and we were in the teenage contest. And I was performing with the daughter of a friend of mine, Dina Lister, Glidden Lister.
Glenn Lister.
JoJo the Clown.
Sure.
Was a good, very good friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew his daughter. His daughter was enough younger than me that we didn't have any romantic interest, but we shared a love of magic and
she was like a younger sister, basically.
Exactly. And she was a ventriloquist. And I told her, I said, I want to be in the contest again. See, because I actually won the contest in 1960. Much to my surprise, I didn't know there was a contest. But in 1961, I knew there was a contest and I wanted to win. Mm-hmm. And so I worked all year and I was doing a bigger show that needed a beautiful assistant. And she agreed. And Glidden said, oh, yeah, she can help you with that. And so she was my beautiful assistant in 1961. I thought we did a fantastic show. I was very proud of it. But we didn't win. The winner was a brother act, Tommy Britton and his brother, who had a comedy magic act. And so then 5-10 years later, whatever it was, Tom and Dina fell in love and got married. And so I always accuse her of leaving me for the magician that beat us in the contest. Of course, there was no, that had nothing to do with anything. But Dina and Tom and I have been friends for life.
And she stopped doing ventriloquism couple decades ago, I think, basically. It's been a while.
Not that long. She used to be very active in the Houston Puppetry Guild, mm-hmm. and she'd bring me in as a marketing lecturer, and my mom is a puppeteer, so, you know, mom was active in that as well. So.
And she's the one who gave you your first Gilbert Misto magic set?
My dad.
Your dad did.
Yep.
Which I think is interesting, and that was what got you started, as a lot of magicians got started with the first magic kit, and that's, tell that story. I think that was interesting.
Sure. My grandpa was the manager of the Buckhorn, a very famous...
Oh, in San Antonio, the Buckhorn Brewery?
In San Antonio, yeah.
The bar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's before the breweries picked it up.
Was that Jack's or was that Pearl Brewery?
That was Pearl.
Pearl. And they had all these horns. It was a
right.
Hall of horns, basically antlers and everything, in the bar area.
But that was later.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The original museum was on Houston Avenue, the main thoroughfare there in San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And my grandpa was the manager of it. And they had a little magic counter in their gift shop. And he gave
me... Lou Berkey had... Was his shop open at that point?
Yes.
Okay, but you hadn't been in there yet.
I hadn't been in there yet.
Okay.
That's correct.
I'm jumping ahead.
Yeah, you are. And so it was 1949, would have been the summer of 1949 when I went to visit my grandpa mm-hmm. in San Antonio, and he gave me a little coin slider trick, a little trick that magicians are all familiar with. Mm-hmm. Mostly they come in plastic now, but of course they were wood back then.
Made in Japan.
Made in Japan, because that's where the crappy stuff came from back then, and mm-hmm. now they're made in China. Mm-hmm. No comment. And my dad noticed how much I loved that trick.
Yeah.
And so he thought, well, and so he gave me a... Well, let me tell the story. I woke up Christmas morning, December 25th, 1949, and we lived in a two-story house, and I ran up and down and looked down at the Christmas tree. It was a huge Christmas tree with an electric train going around it and way too many presents. I mean, it was just amazing. And it was traditional in our family that we would open Daddy's present last. And so when it came time to open up the present from my dad, it looked like it might be a Monopoly set or something like that, except that we had Parcheesi, we had Monopoly, you know, we had most of the famous games. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't know what it was, but I ripped the paper off and it said A.C. Gilbert Misto Magic Set. And I said, huh, wow. And so I didn't open it. I went upstairs and closed the door to my bedroom so my brother Carter wouldn't bother me, my younger brother, about 4 years younger. And I lifted the lid on it, and here's all this stuff. I had no idea what most of it was. And I said, oh, I'm going to be a magician. And most little boys in the 40s had that kind of an experience of, mm-hmm. I'm going to be a magician, I'm going to be a baseball player, I'm going to be a this, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I never grew out of it.
Never wavered from your...
Never grew out mm-hmm. of it. From that moment, I said, I'm going to be a magician. And I was obsessed with magic. If I looked at furniture, I wanted furniture that looked magical. If I wanted clothes, I wanted clothes that looked magical.
Wait, along that line, that story about the glass houlette.
Yeah.
Explain that too. That was kind of cool.
Sure. Dad gave me the next biggest magic set from A.C. Gilbert every year. They had the Erector sets, the chemistry sets, and they had a series of them. They had a small one that probably cost $1.98 back then, and then the next biggest one, and then the next biggest one, and so on. And the biggest one came in a big red suitcase that had four holes in it and dowels inside that so you could make the suitcase into a table. Hmm. And it had black cloth so you could have a table, maybe make a backdrop, a table drape. It had posters in it.
Hmm.
And it had this rising card trick with a glass houlette, which was just beautiful. And I had never seen anything like that before, and I really loved it. The mechanism was just the explanation of how to fasten a black thread to it, you know, mm-hmm. and walk away from it.
Because it really was nothing more than just what some people may not know who led it is. It's like a flower vase, but made to hold a deck of playing cards.
Yeah, basically. A flower vase or a wine glass, except that
it's flat.
The goblet is the shape of a deck of cards.
A deck of cards, right.
Yeah.
There you go.
And it was just beautiful. And one day, I was a kid, and one day I dropped it and it broke. And I was crushed.
Sure.
So was it.
Yeah.
And I talked to my mom and dad, and I think dad says, well, why don't you write to him and see if you can get another one? Mm-hmm. And I thought, I didn't know any better. And so I wrote a letter to Mr. A.C. Gilbert, and I said, Mr. Gilbert, I love magic. Your first magic set got me started. I call myself Misto the Magician, and I'm crushed that this glass houlette, I probably didn't call it a houlette, this glass card holder broke. I wonder if there's any way I could buy another one. Mm-hmm. And he had his people write back to me and say, we do not sell that separately, and it's no longer in our set. But Mr. Gilbert told us we had to find one for you. We did, and we're sending it to you. You don't have to pay. And yes, here's an autographed picture of Mr. Gilbert to go with it.
And you still have that picture?
Oh, yeah.
Of course you do.
So I have an autographed picture of Mr. Gilbert. I have a letter from the A.C. Gilbert Company on their letterhead, and I'm not going to break that particular card holder.
That is very, very cool. So as far as getting started in the military, I'm always curious. There are very few people I knew who did magic in the military pretty much as a full-time job as opposed to doing whatever else. So how did they ask you to do magic, or they found out about it? They said, hey, you need to go do this.
Yeah, I never did it as a full-time job, but I did lots of magic performing while I was in college, and ROTC was required from all male students for 2 years.
At LSU.
At LSU. And we had the draft back then, and so I knew I was going to be going into the Army, and I wanted to go in as a lieutenant instead of a private, so mm-hmm. I finished my 4 years of ROTC.
So you wouldn't be on the front line as a point man in Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, we weren't even thinking about Vietnam in 1961.
Okay.
It was just the Army. And so I did get commissioned, and I got married, and I graduated, and we went over to Germany. And I said, I need to do magic shows. And so I started doing magic shows for the clubs over there. Mm-hmm. And I had to get permission because commissioned officers can't do part-time jobs that aren't appropriate. So, for example, I couldn't pump gas at a gas station. I couldn't work in a thrift shop. You're not allowed to carry an umbrella or push a baby carriage. There are all these things that a commissioned officer is not allowed to do. So I wrote a letter to the judge.
Unbecoming of an officer or something, basically.
Exactly.
Who knows? Right.
And the Judge Advocate General, of course, says, nobody's asked if being a magician is appropriate or not. Sure, go for it.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't say it like that. Yeah. I got a letter, but still. And so I had permission to perform, and I eventually got an agent and did a lot of magic shows in Germany, and my wife was my beautiful assistant.
Now, in Germany, were they for the Army and families, or were they just for German families?
Most of them were for Army clubs.
Okay, in English. So you guys speak in English,
right?
Okay,
right. I did some for German audiences, and I learned just a little bit of pidgin German so that I could include that in my shows.
Sure. And you were doing illusions at the time too, or not? Or more just stand up as we call it today.
Well, I was doing the giant top hat illusion, producing a girl in a bunny costume from a giant top hat. I was doing the guillotine.
Did you buy that or build that?
The top hat I built. The guillotine I got from UF Grant.
And they shipped it over to the Germany?
Yeah, they marked it toys.
Wow, okay. All right.
So, yeah, I had a few illusions that I did in the mm-hmm. show. And then I got curtailed for Vietnam. And so when I went to Vietnam, I couldn't take my illusions or anything. But even though I was there during the Tet Offensive, even though the war was on, I found time to find a few guys and put them together to play in a band. And so they were my band, and we started a little show called Wartime Wizardry, performing for the GIs, performing for the troops. And I did that whenever I could, when I was not, actually working.
That's what I was wondering still. So that was not necessarily your job. What was your actual job? In the Army.
Being a performer was never my job. I asked if I could be in special services and do magic. And they said, no, because you're an officer. If you were in special services, you'd be in charge of the groups that bring in the performers.
The perception of an officer needs to be at a certain level.
Exactly.
Okay, interesting.
Exactly. So it was never my job, but I was always able to convince them that it was okay for me to do it off duty.
Off duty, right. And, but you wouldn't be billed as Colonel Cummins.
No.
Right, okay.
I was not.
But it's interesting then coming back and getting involved the way you did with a lot of other corporate clients. Did you immediately start going into marketing and thinking this was what your course was going to be of helping companies? You had to be on the forefront of some of these kinds of team building activities because this has only been around for a couple of decades.
Well, once again, I'm doing a lot of things at once. When the Army sent me to get my MBA at UT, and we started the sandwich shops, I started using magic in the marketing for the sandwich shops. Mm-hmm. And so, again, it was a part-time job. Well, even running the sandwich shops was sort of a part-time job mm-hmm. because I was a full-time graduate student.
At school, right.
Yeah. And then we went to Korea, which is where my next beautiful assistant came from when we adopted our daughter. And I did magic shows over there. But again, it wasn't my job. My primary job during the 11 years active duty was MWR, which is Morale, Welfare, and Recreation, okay. which means I worked with the clubs, the bowling centers, the golf courses, the libraries, the child care, child development, all of those kinds of things.
When you were with the military, what was one of the most challenging shows or memorable shows? Do you remember something that comes to mind? Perhaps it might have been in a war area or something that happened during a show or you had to stop? Or
I remember one time when I picked up three hand grenades and started juggling them. This did not please my non-commissioned officer who was with me at the time because they were live hand grenades.
Live.
I didn't pull the pins. Oh. You know, I'm not stupid.
You're not stupid.
But yeah, I think I may be one of the few people who has juggled live hand grenades during the Tet Offensive in Vietnam.
And lived to tell about it.
And lived to tell about it, yeah.
Well, wow. Okay. So again, afterwards, when you were doing shows for both IBM, the International Business Machine, and the International Brotherhood of Magicians, but a lot of other corporate companies then as well, have you been flying around the country as well? I guess they kind of take you wherever you need to go.
And I still had connections with the military, so I still was doing stuff in Germany and around the world, really.
Yeah. And what has been the most fulfilling or one of the shows where you felt like some group that you worked with it felt like, hey, they got it, or I helped their company grow, or maybe some show you did?
Because I've done thousands of shows, that's a tough question.
It is, but usually something comes to mind.
But the first thing that comes to mind was a little private party that I did for a couple that had just gotten married or were just getting married. And I brought in a tarot card reader, and I was just helping them have a magical theme to their party. Mm-hmm. And the magic show, I did strolling magic primarily, but I did a little short magic show in their living room. And I can remember we had to push the couch out of the way, and there were people standing all around and whatever. And I did several tricks that are among my favorites, and I tried to use, again, I do magic with a message, so I tried to use that message of love in the magic.
Okay.
When I finished, they started applauding, which mm-hmm. is usually what happens when I finish a show. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't stop
applauding.
They would not stop applauding.
Wow.
They just kept going. I didn't have a timer. I don't know how long it was, but it was long enough that I got incredibly uncomfortable mm-hmm. because there was nothing I could do. I had taken a bow. I had said,
You're finished.
And they just kept applauding. For some reason, my messages using magic mm-hmm. resonated not just with the couple, but with the entire group.
Yeah.
And they felt really good about it. And so I felt really good about it. That's what we all try and do.
Exactly.
To make an emotional difference in people's lives.
What are a few tips as far as marketing for magicians who are listening to this and for their own shows or if you were going to be giving a mini seminar, what kind of an outline would you cover as it relates to magicians in particular?
Yeah, it's not about you. It's about the audience.
That's good advice.
I wrote an entire column on that just a few months ago in Linking Ring. Mm-hmm. And I said, after more than 6 years of writing these columns, I think this one may be the most important one. We are so ego-driven. Even Copperfield will admit that when he got started, it was his ego. It was some way that he could present himself and maybe get girls interested in him and, you know, all the things. As magicians, we are ego-driven. And the best of us eventually get out of that a little bit and begin to realize how important the audience is. And there are far too many of us who never lose that point of view, where it's still always about them. And so what I encourage people to do, they don't really care about your tricks. What they care about is how they feel when you're through.
Mm-hmm.
And to make that work, you have to be very, very focused on the audience, not on your show. And the idea, I admire magicians who have had one show and toured the world for decades with that one show and entertain people. That's great. But if you want to educate and inspire, in addition to entertain, then you need to know what's going on in the audience and what you can do and say that will make a difference for them.
Are you saying then also to pay attention and listen to your audience such that you have a show, but if it's going a particular direction and you think it may not be working, you need to change
Absolutely.
The focus?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't work for somebody that has a tight 8 minutes that
right.
they're doing around the world to music, because not everybody
like Mr.
understands
Electric
English.
Or somebody, right.
Mr. Electric is the first one that came to mind.
Mm-hmm.
What a success story.
Right.
But he had a show, mm-hmm. and it was a good show, and he did it over and over and over, which is why it was such a good show.
Right.
The problem with my approach is that you're not doing exactly the same show every time, and therefore gremlins get in, because it's in the constant performing over and over again that you get really smooth.
Mm-hmm. And you don't often have that opportunity to do that on a regular basis unless you have a club where you can do
exactly.
it on a nightly basis, or a theater
exactly.
or someplace like that. Or if you're working in restaurants, that's an advantage of for close-up guys to be able to do tricks over and over from table to table. It's like,
Absolutely,
okay, I made
yeah.
a mistake here, or I got a line from this table I'm going to use and try at the other table or whatever. But from a standpoint of doing stage shows like you do, unless your agent keeps you booked back-to-back, or you're working college circuit, or you know, someone like Eric Dittleman or whatever, or guys in Vegas like Matt Franco or whomever they're doing night after, that's a completely different situation when you get to a certain level. But building up to that, how do you get that kind of experience? How do you go out and find the shows?
Well, it's interesting. The National Speakers Association is very fond of saying, choose your lane. Be the best speaker for dental hygienists. Be the best speaker for HR. Be the best speaker for... Choose your lane. And I spoke to a friend of mine, Bruce Turkell, who's a wonderful speaker, a branding expert. And I said, I get so frustrated because I don't want to choose a lane. I want a wide variety of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you have your lane. It's a multi-lane highway. Embrace that.
Hmm.
And I learned in 1985 what kind of a person I was as far as working. I became a full-time magician on January 1st, 1986.
Okay.
Before that, I always did magic, but it was never my full-time job.
It was just supplemental income.
It was supplemental income and something I did for fun and for money. But in 1985, I went through the book, What Color Is Your Parachute? It's a website now, of course, but it was just a book back mm-hmm. then. And I literally would stop if they said, why don't you ask your mom what your three greatest strengths are? I would stop, write a letter to my mom, and ask her what my three greatest strengths were.
Yeah.
You know, I would follow every exercise. It took me a year to get through that book because I followed it carefully. And what I learned was, I love doing magic shows, but I don't want to be doing the same show every night, week after week after week. I love teaching, but I don't want to be grading papers every night, week after week after week. I love speaking, but I don't want to be on an airplane weekend after weekend after
right.
weekend. I love lecturing, but I don't want to just lecture. I love writing, but I also love people.
Yeah.
I don't want to be spending 40 hours a week in front of my computer writing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so what I learned is, there are half a dozen things that I love to do. I don't want to do any of them full time. Maybe I can do all of them full time. So it's what Jay Abraham calls multiple streams of income.
Mm-hmm.
And it had worked so well for me, because if I'm getting paid well to write, I can spend a lot of time writing. If that dries up, I may spend more time lecturing, more time performing. I'm a juggler as well as a magician. Sometimes I'll be doing juggling classes or juggling workshops or juggling shows.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my primary.
Right.
But sometimes that's what the market wants. And so I've been able to not do the same thing over and over again for 72 years.
Adjust to the market, basically.
Exactly.
And changing situations.
And it happens to work really well for me. That's what I love, constantly changing situations. It doesn't work for everybody, so you have to know yourself first.
That leads into a nice segue about the Fantastic Magic Camp. There might be some people who want to teach or have perhaps taught some classes or maybe done weeks after school for whatever. How can people get involved in that? And I know it's lucrative and has been for you and Peter and some other guys. I mean, it's a big time thing you do all summer long. But how did that get started and how can someone perhaps follow that kind of a plan?
It was the year I turned 50.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to give back. My life has been so good. I wanted to give back. And I wasn't rich. I couldn't endow anything. And I didn't have a lot of time because I was still trying to earn a living for my family. And I just didn't know what I could do. And I was having breakfast with my friend Robert Crampton, having coffee. And he said, why don't you start a summer camp for kids? You teach magic, you teach juggling, you teach puppets. Why don't you put all that together and start a camp? And
were you teaching individuals or teaching in like small groups or people come to you to
teaching after school programs?
Right. Okay.
I was teaching at UT in their informal classes.
Yeah, community.
People would ask me to help them with their McGruff the Crime Dog puppets, which is how I happened to know Robert Crampton because he ran a McGruff the Crime Dog program. And so I'd just been doing a lot of this teaching and I loved it. And I said, that's an interesting idea. He said, no, it's a business plan.
Right.
And within 3 months, we had the first magic camp. And I thought it would be a little temporary thing I did in the summer for 4 weeks. And it turned into the most important thing I've probably done in my life.
Important meaning because of how lives you changed, you mean?
Oh, thousands of lives have been changed for the better because of Fantastic Magic Camp.
I've heard stories about people from the camp who have parents who say kids are autistic or something. They're coming and saying to you, that's the first time I've ever heard him speak.
We were fully inclusive. And I could tell stories for hours. And I only ran it for the first 18 years because when your kids turn 18, you got to let them go. And so people who were involved with the camp took it over from me after 18 years. And the camp still goes on, and they hire me to do a show, typically for the first day of every session of camp. So I'm still involved with the camp, but I'm not on the board. I don't have anything to do with running it. But they still use the same principles. And to me, that's the most important thing I've done in magic, is to be able to use magic in a way that genuinely improves people's lives.
During this time when we've been doing some Zoom things, I assume you gave Zoom lessons then as well?
Or
online type of things?
Magic classes, juggling classes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, how do you teach juggling online?
Well,
over a video.
I've taught so many people to juggle that I know the principles. I know what mistakes they're going to make.
Good point.
I mean, they're going to make the same mistakes, you know, after teaching over 1,000 people how to juggle. You see what mistakes they're going to make. Somebody comes to me and says, I can do 3, but I can't do 4. I know exactly why they can't do 4, and I can show them very quickly. Somebody comes to me and says, well, I can juggle fine, but clubs, I can't get clubs. I know exactly what their problem is. 99 times out of 100, I know exactly what their problem is and exactly how to show them.
How to fix it.
And that's just the experience. And if you want to teach, the first thing is you have to genuinely love the students. Mm-hmm. So don't teach because you can make a lot of money. Teach because you want to help people and experience.
And if people do want to teach, then the best way it sounds like would be to approach something like a junior college, I would think, where they might have some sort of a community program.
Sure, but recognize that the most important thing is who are the students and what are they going to get, not what tricks are you good at teaching.
Oh, okay. So think about the student and not so much about what you're...
That's why Magic Camp was so successful, because we didn't care whether they learned the ball and vase or not.
Yeah.
What we cared about was, will this kid be successful and go home and say, oh, Mom, I love Magic Camp. I can't wait till I can become a counselor. We had 6-year-old kids with plans for when they were going to become a CIT. They can't become a CIT till they're 13.
CIT meaning?
Counselor in training.
Okay.
So 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. We have a 6-year-old with a 7-year plan. How many of you listening have a 7-year plan, have a plan for what you're going to do 7 years
from now?
Even
right now at this age, whatever you are.
Whatever age, right. And so that's why Magic Camp succeeded, and it made money because people wanted to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't make money because we had a good business plan. It made money because we really cared about the kids and figured out how to help them. We didn't spend a lot of time learning what the best magic tricks were. We spent our time learning, how do you work with a child on the spectrum? How do you work with a child in a wheelchair? How do you work with a child that's blind? How do you how do you teach magic to a child that's totally blind? Mm-hmm. And that's where we spent our time, and that's why it was a success. It remains a success. Right.
I found whenever I was teaching, I quickly learned I had to be smarter than the best question that was going to be asked by any one of the students.
Right.
Because you had to be able to answer that. You can't say, I'll get back to you next week. You have to know. I mean, sure, you have skills, but it's beyond that. You need to know history. You need to know theory and market. There's the whole gamut of everything, and you are obviously the teacher, so you're the resident expert. A student will look up to. And so you need to know all those kinds of things. So there's a lot more. I mean, just thinking if you are a magician, yeah, I'll teach. Well, yeah, there's a lot more research you need to do and put together a syllabus and an outline and all that kind of a thing. Plus finding a venue where they can do this. Where do you guys teach?
Well, at one point, I had 6 magicians meeting once a week to go out and teach in 30 different elementary schools. Hmm. And we all had this
after-school thing.
After-school program.
Yeah.
Right. And, of course, camp, you advertise all the places camps advertise. Mm-hmm. And the University of Texas, it was their informal classes. Now they have a group called OLLI, the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, and they have a variety of classes. And so that's a place to get in. You mentioned junior college. I haven't taught at a junior college because I was teaching at UT, but
that's
a great location. Yeah.
Yeah. Continuing education classes.
Right.
They might have CUC's kind of a thing. When you say a camp also, it's not like an overnight camp, I assume.
I didn't really want to call it a camp because to me, a camp is an overnight and you go swimming.
Right.
But so it's really a workshop, but day camps, that's what day camps are. Mm-hmm. So Magic Camp has always been a day camp.
Yeah.
And that means the kids come in the morning and they leave.
It sounds like
afternoon.
Fun as opposed to a workshop. That sounds like work.
Exactly.
Yeah. Again, marketing.
Yep.
And so that continued, and you were doing that for about 17 years, you said. And
18
then
years.
Peter the Adequate still carries that on. And
Peter the Adequate is now the camp director, and he was the first person I called. Well, the first person I called was my mom because I wanted a puppet teacher. Mm-hmm. But I called Peter, and I said, hey, what do you think about starting a summer camp for kids? And he says, oh, that sounds like great fun. And Peter and I are so totally different that we either can't stand each other and can't work together, or we recognize the yin and yang and work together beautifully.
Yeah,
I can remember times at camp when he would come into me and say, Kent, you're very good at paperwork. Go into the office and do some paperwork. And I knew what that meant is that the camp had gotten chaotic, that mm-hmm. the kids were running all over the place, throwing things at each other and whatever. Yeah. And I'm not good at chaos. But Peter's great with chaos. He can deal with that easily. I like things to be carefully planned. And then I like them to go according to the plan. And
Peter's like an army man.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm a retired army or something. Yeah. And that's not Peter's way at all. Mm-hmm. But I used to get upset because he'd be traditionally late to all of our meetings. And I complained to Margot, my wife, one time. And she says, so stop working with him. I can't stop working with him. He brings all this wonder. She says, then quit complaining about who he is.
Wow.
And that's the secret. The secret is to accept people for who they are. Mm-hmm. Everybody's doing the best they can. They really are.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to deal with somebody, then don't. But if you want to deal with somebody, don't try and change them into who you think they should be. Figure out why you want to deal with them and then accept them that way. And that, to me, is the brilliance of Magic Camp, the success, the thing that I learned.
Right.
Was how to work with a wide variety of people and accept them for who they are instead of who I thought they should be. And you don't know what's going on in their minds. Mm-hmm. And I tell people that when they get mad at somebody for cutting them off in traffic, I say, you don't know
what they're going through,
what that person's going through. Maybe they just heard that their pregnant wife is getting ready to deliver and they weren't expecting it that soon and they're hurrying as fast as they can get. You don't know.
Same thing like with somebody stopping and they're on the phone. You think, get off the phone or quit texting. But it's like, there could be something really serious.
It could be something incredibly serious.
Right.
And the same thing with the kids. If a kid is what we call acting up, it's not because they want to fail. It's not because they want to be punished. It's not because they want to be hated. It's because they don't have the strategies for effectively dealing with the situation.
They're still children.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And our job is not to punish them. Our job is to figure out how we can help them gain strategies. Mm-hmm. Because everybody wants to succeed. Everybody wants to be liked.
Children or adults. They
That's
all want
right.
to. Right. And also be accepted.
Yes. And you don't know what's going on in the audience's mind. And I can remember the first after-school program I taught. It was Austin Independent School District was doing it. And there was this one kid who was just bouncing off the walls. I mean, literally. literally throwing himself into the wall or whatever. Okay. And he would pull the girl's hair. Okay. And he would, I mean, could this kid even be real? And after a few, and he never took his homework. You know, he never took his props home with him. And after a few days, I'm writing up a review of each one because it's a test program. Uh-huh. And I'm writing about how this guy should be pulled because he's not getting anything out of it. And this young Hispanic woman looks in the door and says, "Are you the magic teacher? Do I have to tell you the punchline?" She said, "I just wanted to thank you. My son comes home every day and does a magic trick for us. He was expelled from school and he sneaked onto the campus so he could go to your class."
Wow.
You don't know.
Wow.
We tend to judge what other people are thinking, what they're trying to do and whatever, but we don't know. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we don't know what we're thinking.
Wow. That's true. You don't. Everybody has something different and you have to, I think that comes with age and maturity.
I hope so. Well, my friend, your friend, Doc Stan Seton, mm-hmm. and that was one of his favorite sayings was, "Everybody is doing the best they can."
Give everybody the benefit of the doubt, basically.
Yeah.
Well, talk about working with people, too. You worked at Renaissance Festival with both Ralph Markham and Bill Palmer.
Bill Palmer.
I mean, they're two completely different characters, and yours was a
totally
jester,
different.
Which was different.
Thelonious the Fool.
Yeah.
It was really fun. I was very fortunate at Scarborough Fair. I auditioned, mm-hmm. and they accepted me, which means they would hire me to do a certain number of shows and pay me. Mm-hmm. This is what Bill Palmer was. This is what Ralph Markham was. But they also gave me busking privileges, which I don't think Bill Palmer took advantage of. I didn't see him walking around working for tips. Of course, he was being paid enough. He probably mm-hmm. didn't have to. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Ralph Markham did. But I definitely had busking privileges. And I had this bright red and yellow motley with bells. People wanted to get their pictures taken with me. I could just walk around the grounds and people would come running up to me. And so I got, you know, good money from tips. I did 71 shows during that season. I remember because I kept track of them. Mm. But they also put me in the performing company. The performing company doesn't get paid, but they get this incredible training. They bring in professional theater trainers and teachers. And so I got to sit in on all of that. I got to lead the parade. I was at opening ceremony, closing ceremony, and I wasn't getting paid for that. So I was the only person at Scarborough Fair that had three different ways to operate.
Right.
I did pay shows. I did stuff free as part of the performing company, and then I got money from tips.
In the stage show.
Yep.
Yeah. Wow. And working with people, do you prefer having assistants or do you like doing a one-man show? I mean, having done both.
I don't know that I like lots of different things.
Yeah.
I already said that.
Yeah. You know,
I love, we recently did a show for Marbridge, which is a home for adults with intellectual disabilities, and they wanted it to be a really big show. So, you know, big show. We had two tech people, two women and one guy on stage, plus me. I was the star of the show because I was the one that was hired. Mm-hmm. But the other people all performed in different ways. So, I mean, that I love doing a show like that has six or seven people in order to make it work. But it's fun to just bring what's in my pockets and entertain people for an hour by myself and everything in between. What I don't want is to do this. I didn't want to do that Marbridge show every week. Oh, my God, that was a lot of work.
Yeah.
But I don't want to just wander around and do tricks for people. I don't do tricks at family gatherings or groups of friends or that sort of stuff. Doing magic is how I made my living.
Right.
And if somebody asks me, "Oh, will you please do a trick?" My wife explained to me it would be rude to not do something. But I do something quick.
Mm-hmm. And what do you carry with you if it's a quick thing?
Almost nothing.
What do you do?
One of the things I do is take the napkin that's on the table that's never quite big enough and stretch it and stretch it and stretch it until it gets big enough, just like Harry Blackstone Sr. did with the borrowed white gentleman's handkerchief.
He also did a thing where he tied the two ends together, and that's not a knot. That's an invisible knot.
And I've done that with the napkin.
Yeah.
I've made the salt shaker disappear,
yeah.
You know, instead of the coin, you know, that trick.
Yeah.
Any small object I can make appear or disappear, mm-hmm. you know, whatever. But I don't, when I was in high school, I used to carry around a cigar box packed to the gills with every little trick thing I could find.
Yeah.
And if people didn't want me to perform, I'd go sit in the corner and pout. Literally, I'm not making this up. Margot remembers because we were dating back then. I was so self-absorbed.
Yeah.
I was in magic because of ego needs.
Yeah.
And over the years, I've been able to see that there's more to it than that.
Well, Jeff McBride has always said, if you're a magician is supposed to perform.
And Jeff McBride thoroughly believes that you should always be a magician.
Correct.
If you're a magician.
24/7.
And I believe that Jeff McBride should always be a magician 24/7. But I do not believe that Grandpa should always be a magician, or that Kent should always be a magician, or that Daddy should always be a magician, or Captain Cummins or Colonel Cummins should always be a magician.
Mm-hmm.
I've chosen to make magic probably the overriding theme of my life, but I'm not always
on.
Yeah. Now, I'm always a magician because that's like I'm always this old white guy.
Right.
But no, I'm not always on.
Well, that kind of brings me around to the question of, again, you've been doing it for 72 years, and we were talking earlier off air before we began about continuing this or not. I had spoken with David Hira in a couple of episodes, but in one in particular, which was his swan song. He was saying, I'm out. I don't want to carry on, and for someone to say, who is that old guy up on stage? And you had this kind of epiphany. I want you to tell that little story about what your thoughts are.
Sure. One of my best friends in magic was Fred Scott Donaldson, the great Scott. And we did lots of stuff together, and he was always our feature performer at Magic Camp. And then one year he said, okay, Judy and I are going to do one more show for Magic Camp. It's your last session, and then we're not going to perform anymore. So you're not coming to Magic Camp anymore? He says, no, I'm not performing anymore. And I said, Fred, you're at the top of your game.
Mm-hmm.
He said, that's when I want to stop. I don't want to be one of those old guys that's embarrassing and drop stuff on stage. And I thought, huh. And I respected that. And so a few years later, when he was older than I was, but a few years later, when I turned 64, I said, I'm doing my When I'm 64 tour.
Right.
I'm going to do 64 shows this year. And I set up a Google calendar for the When I'm 64 tour so my friends could follow me and make sure I really did 64 shows.
Was it around Texas or just in region?
Whenever. Wherever.
And they're all public shows.
Not necessarily. One might be for the magic camp. One might be for the magic club.
Okay.
As long as I'm doing a performance and doing some magic,
gotcha.
Then it counts.
That counts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was in the spring of that year, and I got a call from Cy Albertson, who was running a magic shop in the area, and he said, I'm bringing in John Calvert, and I'd like you to introduce him if you would. And I said, well, I'd be thrilled. I've heard of John Calvert. I've read all about him in Genie. I've seen his book. I couldn't afford to buy it, but I know he's famous. Why me? And Cy laughed. He says, well, I need somebody with a little class, and you've got a tuxedo. And I have no idea why he actually, I'm sure Cy has a tuxedo as well. But for whatever reason, he let me be the master of ceremonies, which was a wonderful honor. And I watched John Calvert perform. And he was incredible. His sleight of hand skills were better than mine. And he was wonderful with audience participation and bringing volunteers up on stage. And he had a beautiful assistant on stage. And he did a large illusion. And he did comedy. And I thought, he's better than me. And he was 94 years old at that particular year. He was exactly 30 years older than me.
30 years older, right.
And I said to myself, okay, if he's that good at 94, maybe I can go a few more years. And I put together a focus group of people that I respected, one of whom not only had never seen me perform, had never seen a magician perform. And one of them was Peter the Adequate, my longtime magic partner, mm-hmm. friend. And there were about six people, male and female, old and young, tech people, magic people, ordinary people, real people. And we talked about how was I going to perform in the future. Should I concentrate on corporate events, which I was pretty good at and which make roughly 10 times the amount of money of a school show, mm-hmm. of a kid show? Or should I focus on kids because I love and care about kids?
Sure.
And we decided that I didn't care about the 10 times fee so much, that I can make a greater difference in a 10-year-old's life than I can a 60-year-old's life,
mm-hmm.
just because of the amount of years coming up.
True.
And so I decided I would focus especially on working with young people. And should I call myself the Fantastic Kent Cummins or use one of Misto the Magician again or whatever? And so we just talked about all those things. But what I asked them, what I told them is, you have to tell me if I stop getting better. I'm going to work really hard to to be a good magician. I want to be as good as John Calvert. I'm going to work really hard. But you have to tell me not when I plateau, not when I start getting worse, but when I stop getting better. And I have a feeling they would have told me this some time ago if I hadn't started working with my granddaughter, the amazing Adele. And Peter's the first one that told me. He said, Adele has just added so much to your show and to mm-hmm. your excitement. And you're just, you're more fun, more comfortable, more relaxed, more just sharing the fun of magic with people. And that's, of course, what I want from my show. I don't want people to say, oh, gosh, you are a really good magician. I want them to say, oh, gosh, that was fun.
Yeah, yeah. Do you like it whenever people say that as opposed to it's like, oh, I like this particular trick?
Well, I know what the people are going to ask me. What kind of magic do you do? They're going to ask me what's your favorite trick. They're going to ask who's your favorite magician. So I have answers to all those things.
No, but that wasn't my question. What I mean is after the show is over and an audience member will come to you and say, oh, I like when you stepped out of that book or the smoke and you appeared or whatever that is, a particular trick. Or it's like, I just like it all. You were fun. I had a fun evening.
Oh, of course.
You like the latter.
You know the answer to that.
I know the answer. That's right. I do. And I think that's all what we're all aspiring to have. And you continue to get better and continue to inspire not just youth, but me and a lot of other people. You've been involved in so many things like we've covered over here and in your lifetime. And the people you've known and worked with, it's just been incredible.
I've had an absolutely marvelous life. It's been fun. It's been exciting. I've gotten to do a lot of things that nobody else has ever done.
Right.
And lots of things that few people have ever done. And so my goal in retirement is to be able to share those things. But I also, as you know, have a deep love for the art of magic, the ephemera, the memorabilia, the books, the posters, mm-hmm. the things. And that's why I started the auction so many years ago,
right,
to try and keep stuff out of the landfill mm-hmm. and keep it recirculating. And that's why I started the Fantastic Magic Center, where we are now sitting in the library. And I have just opened a Patreon account so that people can help me in this journey of keeping magic for magicians and saving the stuff. When I hear that somebody's copy of Genie magazine, volume 1, number 1, was thrown away with the rest of the trash mm-hmm. when the magician died, it just hurts me.
Well, that leads me kind of almost full circle to get to the ending over here of how can people patronize this center and also how can they visit or get in touch with you if they need to make an appointment because this is a home that's been converted.
Like David Copperfield's so-called secret museum in Las Vegas, my museum does not have any signage for different reasons. And I'll also echo David in something else. He recently did an interview with the Skeptical Inquirer, and they were talking about the incredible stuff he has in his museum. And he said, yes, I've been fortunate to collect that stuff, but it's not about the stuff. It's about the stories. And so what I'm trying to preserve is, sure, there's a lot of interesting stuff, but what I'm trying to preserve is the stories that I've had a unique input into so that those don't get lost. Because David doesn't have my stuff.
Right.
He's got lots of his own stuff.
Well, and stuff of other people he collected, he acquired, whereas these are things you personally have acquired. And as you show me, like these posters, this is the Kent Cummins Magic Museum. Really, it has a lot of your personality and
of course
you
it does.
And your family in here.
That's what makes it unique.
Yes.
And anybody that wants to visit is welcome. They just need to get in touch with me. And
how
the easiest way is kent@kentcummins.com.
That's C-U-M-M-I-N, no G.
Correct.
N-S.
C-U-M-M-I-N-S. Or kent@magichotline.com, which is the business address. But either of those work. Look up Kent Cummins on Facebook and you'll find me. And you can send me a Facebook message. Mm-hmm. I'm delighted to show it off. It's really fun. And I just barely started working with the Patreon account, but if you're able to financially support the preservation of the art of magic, this place costs me a couple $1,000s a month, and sometimes I don't have that money. Mm-hmm. And so any money that is donated goes directly in. One family donated $5,000 as a one-time donation because I was helping them with their dad's magic collection mm-hmm. and helping get it used and distributed rather than thrown away. And they said, we love the fact that it's organized. We love the fact that our dad's stuff is now on display.
Right.
We want you to be able to keep doing this. Here's a little check. And the little check happened to be for $5,000.
Nice. Yeah. Any amount, any every amount is helpful.
Yeah, you know, Patreon, I mean, you can start at $5 a month.
Right, with a small pledge or as much as you want then as well. I use Patreon as well. It's an out. And so they go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com. Right. And what would they look for?
Fantastic Magic Center.
Fantastic Magic Center. There you go. Check that out. Well, as we do wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. I know you're a listener and a longtime listener, first time caller. But you, what would be your philosophy? We've talked about so many different things over here that are important to you, but how would you close out with that?
Well, people always tell me I'm so ridiculously positive all the time that I bloom where I'm planted. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive, but I find a way to do magic shows and have fun in between all the bad stuff that's going on. When I was in the sixth grade, my dad gave me a copy of Dr. Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking. I read it, I believed it, and then later as a young adult, I got to hear him speak in person and meet him and talk to him and tell him the effect it made in my life.
Wow.
And so, sure, there's The Magic of Believing by Claude Bristol. There's the Magic Words Attitude by Earl Nightingale. I mean, yes, I've read all those books, and I believe them all, but you know, basically, you have to take what's there and make the best of it. We can't always figure out what's going to happen to us, but we can figure out how we're going to react to it. I always tell people when they ask how I am, I say, I'm fantastic. And yeah, it's a catchphrase. But by saying it, I feel it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes somebody will say, oh, I wish I could say that. I said, you could. We create our own reality. Why not create one that's fantastic?
I love that. Create your own reality, yeah.
And my friend Chris Walden, who's been a guest on your podcast, is fond of saying Kent doesn't have a rearview mirror. He says nothing bad's ever happened to him. I happen to know that terrible things have happened to him, but he doesn't have a rearview mirror. He doesn't look back. He doesn't worry about it. And upon reflection, I think that's true. I think I'm fortunate that I'm able to just enjoy life the way it is.
I love that. Wow. Enough said. Thank you, Kent, very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Especially your friendship. This has been wonderful. So for the Magic Word Podcast, here from the Fantastic Magic Center, that was Kent Cummins. This is Scotty out. Thank you, Kent, for sharing your years of experience and stories with us. That was just fantastic. What can I say? I appreciate that. And I hope all of you listeners enjoyed that as much as I did. That was just really cool. And also, I want to remind you to visit themagicwordpodcast.com this week's episode, number 680, where you will then see several of the photos that I had taken while I was there at the Fantastic Magic Center. I think you'll enjoy that as well. And want to remind everyone that next week we will be attending the Magic Live. That's going to be a huge convention. And as it always is, well, I say always, they haven't had it for the last few years, so this will be the first time out of the chute, and I know everyone is anxious to get to Las Vegas and see what Stan has in store for us. I will be presenting daily updates commencing on Monday the 19th. The convention begins on the 18th, so I'll be recording conversations with the organizers like Stan, hopefully, if I can pull him aside for a few minutes, as well as some of the dealers, registrants, and the talent, and just whoever's kind of hanging around. Just kind of give you a good feel of what the convention is like, as I always do with my daily reports, and I'll post that as soon as I get back to the room, and that'll probably be sometime late on Sunday night or early Monday the 19th, and so I will each of the 4 days be updating you with these reports. So be sure to come back here, and if you have not yet subscribed to our pod letter, please, while you're at themagicwordpodcast.com, you'll see an opportunity there where you can subscribe, and each week we will keep you up to date, let you know who's on from week to week, as well as suggestions from the archives of some people you may have overlooked or those who are worth another listen. So until next week, when I will be in Las Vegas, stay well, get booked, and remember to create your own reality. This is Scotty out.